Welcome to Econ Talk, Conversations for the Curious, part of the Library of Economics and Liberty. I'm your host, Russ Roberts of Shalem College in Jerusalem and Stanford University's Hoover Institution. Go to econtalk.org where you can subscribe, comment on this episode, and find links and other information related to today's conversation. You'll also find our archives with every episode we've done going back to 2006. Our email address is mail@econtalk.org. We'd love to hear from you. Today is September 3rd, 2025, and my guest is Toby Stewart, the Leo Helzel Chair in Entrepreneurship and Innovation at the Haas School of Business at UC Berkeley. Our topic for today is his book, Anointed, The Extraordinary Effects of Social Status in a Winner-Take-Most World. Toby, welcome to Econ Talk.
Thanks, Russ. Thrilled to be here. Really, really excited for our conversation.
Me too. What's the central idea of the book? Why'd you call it Anointed?
So Anointed, I have to say, I think I probably called it Anointed because it harkens back to my Catholic school, my Catholic high school, and these, a non-Catholic and Catholic school, but these biblical references kind of landed with me. And then, but Anointed gets to just a central part of the book, which is this idea about social status that it moves around. So it moves from actor A to actor B. That is, actors that have high status bestow it upon others. And that happens in the cosmic scheme of things, like anointment in a biblical sense, or anointment in modern life. Like, we use that word colloquially, and we use it often to mean some kind of status event that's more of a rite of passage. So you graduate from college, or something happens where your status is elevated. But it also happens, call it micro anointment or something. It happens on a daily basis all the time, everywhere. And the central idea of it is that status moves around, and that transference process. Anointments, consecrations, endorsements are vitally important to the distribution of opportunity.
Yeah, you've been anointed as a guest on Econ Talk. Now, it's a modest return. It's a modest investiture. But it's an interesting way to think about the world. And you are, at times, I think, somewhat positive toward this concept, but mostly critical of it. But I want to start with some of the positive benefits, which, you can think of them as the benefits of hierarchy. A different way to think about anointment is that there's some people at the top, and they get, as you suggested a minute ago, more opportunity. They often get more resources. They certainly get more prestige, a non-monetary but quite important benefit. So another way to think about this, which you write about, is hierarchy. Hierarchy, despite its non-egalitarian and somewhat negative implications, has some hierarchy has some benefits. What are they?
Yeah, I mean, so let's just go back to the beginning of that comment. And you're too modest. I'm genuinely delighted to be here. And I mean, I'll tell you, I'm doing a bunch of podcasts concurrent with the launch of the book, and so I've listened to them, and I started listening to Econ Talk, and I think I ended up listening to like 10 episodes or something like that, because I just really enjoyed it. Both the interviewer and the interviewees. So actually, I feel like I'm thrilled to be here. Yeah. So hierarchy is everywhere, and without kind of mincing words, like, hierarchies are true, and they exist in pretty much all social scientific disciplines in some form, and they exist in nature in all places. So this, this hierarchical ordering of human beings, or of mammals, or of objects, or of universities. Like, we're a couple of academics talking to one another. Like, talk about a hierarchical world. Universities and our obsession with ranking and faculty and various forms of rankings. These hierarchies are everywhere. And when you see something that's everywhere, it's generally there's a reason for that. And so the book dives into a bunch of the reasons for why hierarchies exist. But let me just make a couple remarks, and then we can jump into whatever aspect of this seems most interesting. But one is that yes, hierarchies form everywhere. Two is that one of their central roles is that they tend to dictate how resources are allocated. So in the animal world where it all began, hierarchies are dominance hierarchies, and they dictate who gets the two most important resources, which are nourishment and mates. And the distribution of those resources is unequal across the dominance hierarchy, just as the distribution of opportunity is unequal across the status hierarchy, and unequal in a way that probably most of us wouldn't think is particularly fair if we understood, you know, kind of the true origin of that distribution of opportunity. And so I think when you know, your sense that I'm critical of the status hierarchy, that's getting into how it impacts who gets what and whether, in fact, it's a fair way to allocate resources.
But there are positives, which you start with.
There are positives. And the positives are, you know, it is a way to allocate resources that isn't we punch one another in the face. So one is, you know, and let's go all the way back to, you know, Leviathan, which we both probably read in graduate school, but no one likes man in the state of nature without some sort of social organization to you know, to keep him in check. And the dominance hierarchy is a way to do that. So if you're imagining, like, you know, go back to hunter-gatherer world where we need to exist in social groups to have any chance of survival. Like, we need to work together, we need to build shelter, we need to hunt, we need to create an agricultural system, we need to do whatever we need to do to acquire the resources for survival. Well, to do that, we have to be in a group. And if we're in a group and we get resources, we then have to figure out how they're split up. And without a system, of which a status hierarchy is one, for allocating resources, we just dispute. Like, you think you deserve it, I think I deserve it, she thinks she deserves it, everybody thinks they deserve it, and we end up, you know, literally punching one another in the face back in the old days. And so the status hierarchy prevents that, and that's, you know, much of the origin of it. In the modern world, you know, the book argues it does a whole lot more than that. And, you know, the other kind of main functions of the status hierarchy is, one, it helps us resolve uncertainty and judgment. So we rely on it all the time in ways that I think most of us often don't recognize. We make status-based decisions just intuitively or reflexively. So it helps us very much in deciding what to do. It also is very influential behind every scene, so to speak. And that is when we make choices, particularly in the modern world, and let's, you know, get into this as we go on, but choice, you know, and I bet you've done, you know, 50 past episodes that touch on this in one way, shape, or form, but choice is, like, often near infinite. Like, there's so much optionality, and there's so many things, and there's so many options for what and how you do and what you consume in the modern world. That all has to get curated. And the status hierarchy is just this gigantic behind the scenes curator of whatever gets in front of you in the first place. So allocation of resources, reduction of choice, navigation to a choice, those are three of the key things that it does for us.
So I really found the idea of it simplifying choice fascinating. I am not a big fan of the worrisome nature of the so-called paradox of choice. I like lots of choices, but I don't want to pretend when you force me to think about the fact that, you know, I don't try everything, and I don't have a perfect system or an algorithm for figuring it out. You know, you're talking about books, obviously blurbs, quotes from other authors or so-called experts count. The answer is, well, question is, why is that? And you can give some answers, but a lot of times a well-blurbed book is awful. There are great books that are unblurbed or relatively unblurbed. So this is not a small thing that you're pointing to. And ironically, perhaps, the past episode that comes to mind first is not what you might have thought about the paradox of choice or utility maximization. It was actually episodes we did with Cynthia Haven and Jonathan By, and I'm forgetting how to pronounce his name. I apologize. I might be right on René Girard and the idea of mimesis, this idea of imitation. And as an economist, I mean, imitation is an appalling idea. I mean, we're supposed to maximize utility, optimize according to the Homo economicus. The idea that I would just imitate somebody, copy what they do, is deeply disturbing, both to my natural instincts as an economist and as my perhaps inflated view of myself as a person with agency. But the idea of anointed, is there's a lot of that laying around influencing me in ways that I probably don't realize.
So much in that question. But so again, I'll go back to the beginning and say, I think unlike you, I've thrown down the white flag. Like when it comes to choice, don't give it to me. Like, I mean, I want to curate it. So there is, I think a lot of us spend an enormous amount of time working, you know, this is a little bit beside the topic of the book, but thinking about choices that are irrelevant. And so if we just made them and got on with it, life would be better for us. I mean, I'm at the moment obsessed with the concept of agency, but that's, you know, that's because of AI, and maybe we can come back and talk about that later. But yeah, I mean, mimicry. So there is so much mimicry. And what happens is if you are high status, it's nearly guaranteed that somebody is going to, that many people are going to mimic you, and that mimicry is a form of homage. Like, I mean, you're deeply influenced by somebody or something to the point that that you mimic them. And if you're like them, you know, the hope is often that there's some status-based benefit that rubs off on you, right? I mean, and so, you know, in its own way, conspicuous consumption of any form is a type of mimicry.
Yeah, well, to take it to the next level, if I respect a particular person or author and they write a good blurb on a book, I like to think that after reading the book and enjoying it, I think, wow, that I was right to respect that endorsement. But it's possible that it colors the way I read the book. And I think, well, if so-and-so liked it, it must be a good book. And afterwards, I rave about it, even though, again, this is a question of agency and actual autonomy. There is the possibility, I don't like the idea of it, but there is the possibility that I'm influenced in ways I don't appreciate.
The blurb on the book is this fascinating thing, right? Because it's just a few words. It tells you very little. Let me ask you this, Russ. How many lousy blurbs have you ever read? Like, how many times have you ever read on a book cover, this is a horrific, this is a terrible book, don't open it?
Zero.
Yeah. So there's like, you know, there's no real information.
So we call in economics a selection bias. Yeah. We don't take a random collection of people's impressions of the book. Yeah.
And you know, this is true for all reviews, right? And all things, right? Because any Yelp reviews I just find so interesting. But let's leave that for now. So we're talking, in the economics world, we're talking about signals. But the signals have, you know, they have one valence, which is positive. And so all you can determine based on a blurb is, do you recognize the name of, you know, the identity of the person who wrote the blurb? But if you think about that, we've just shifted what constitutes a worthwhile book to who blurbed it and who the author is versus what's inside of it. And, you know, and so books in your field, you're going to make sense of. So you will actually be a very good judge of you know, let's call quality of a book if you read it. And, you know, not necessarily a universal judge, but from your standpoint, you're going to come to a judgment and you're going to feel probably conviction in the judgment. Like, this was a good use of a day, or it was a poor use of the day. You learned something. You thought it was well written. You thought it was fun or funny or compelling in some way, or you didn't. You're going to make that judgment. So, you know, make of them what you will. This is neither of our fields. But in the process of writing this, I found this, I thought it was a pretty hilarious fMRI study. So functional magnetic resonance. So these are the brain imaging studies where you neuropsychologists look inside of brains in a scanner when we're making decisions, and then sort of make attributions about how we feel about things based on what regions of the brain light up and how they light up as we're making choices. So there's this one study which I found, which kind of gets to what I think you might call the core thought experiment in the book, which is they take like a bottle of Tubuk Chuck, so really an expensive wine, and they serve it up to somebody who's going into a scanner. And then they take the same Tubuk Chuck and they put it in a bottle of wine that's a label that many people would recognize. So it's the same product, literally. Like, it is this, it's Tubuk Chuck in both, it's cheap wine in both bottles. But it turns out, if I give you cheap wine in an expensive bottle and you're like most of us, you're going to recognize the label on the bottle, and you're going to have a different physiological experience to the wine, and you're going to believe that you liked it more. But you're not going to, but you didn't like it more because it's different or better in any way. It's the same wine. What you're responding to is the identity of the logo, and you're reassessing the identical product based on what the label is on the bottle.
Yeah, I'm somewhat skeptical of those studies, partly because of selection bias, of course. If you showed that most people didn't love the wine when it was in the fancy bottle any more than they did when it was in the crummy bottle, you wouldn't get published. So there is a little bit of a publication bias there. But I think there's a second question, which is spur of the moment in an experiment, your response is going to be different than if you took it home. And you know, it happens supposedly in bars, right? They rebottle the cheap scotch and put it into the fancy bottle, which you can't observe. It's done when the bar's closed. It's not done in front of you. I've always been a little skeptical of that. I have a pretty good palate. I don't have a world-class palate, I'm sure. But I'm pretty good at being disappointed in things I paid a lot for, expecting to be great, and finding out that they're bad. The same would be true of blurbs that are wildly enthusiastic. But it's possible I do that in other areas without realizing it. And maybe I'm unusual in my ability to, I'm a bit of a contrarian, which means that I don't like the whole idea of people telling me what's good. And so I have a rebellious streak. So I'm open to the possibility that there's more there.
Yeah, I mean, I do like to, I mean, just we can move on. I mean, there's hundreds of studies that show this just across, you know, they're not fMRI studies. They just show
it with water.
I mean, you could think of you could think about the audit studies with resumes as an example of the same thought experiment where basically, you know, what I want to say is that there are many of these experiments where you take literally, and it's the way the book opens with a bunch of different, you know, sort of fun stories around this, but where you take literally the same object and then you change the identity of the person associated with it or the organization, and people completely reassess its value. And they're doing that, but the only thing you've changed in the experiment is the identity of the person, like whatever product we're talking about. It's like the bottle of wine, right? But I mean, I have to say that like someone once told me, and I've believed it ever since and repeated it 100 times, that if you got a PhD and you're a social scientist, you should consider yourself non-representative of the general population about nearly everything.
Like, fair enough.
I mean, you know, you, like an economist walks into, you know, a grocery store and what happens? Well, whatever happens isn't what happens when, you know.
Well, that's fair. But I also want to raise the possibility that I alluded to earlier, which I think is interesting, that you actually have a different experience. It's not just your brain. You called it a physiological experience. I think that's very possible. It's, and I think we're not very sensitive to it. And a book like this makes you at least consider it. You know, obviously, a product that's endorsed by a certain person, you could enjoy it more than if it were not endorsed by that person, a person that you respect, admire, revere. It's not just that you're fooling yourself. You might actually have some kind of emotional connection through that endorsement that is, quote, real. But it doesn't change your point, which is there's a lot of power. Obviously, people with name recognition, celebrity status, people who are adulated, obviously can anoint, they're anointed, and they can anoint others and products and raise the status of those products. Let's talk about the counterpoint. You can respond in a sec, but I want to turn to the worker bee approach, which is a little bit, which is an alternative. So you can say, if you want to respond to that, fine. But otherwise,
definitely want to. I want to respond to that one because you actually just got to, like, I mean, there's 5 or 6 meta points or whatever, like, you know, and you got to one of them, but and that is that you actually have a different perception of a product because it's affiliated in some way. Like, it's blurbed by somebody you really respect. It's a book, and that actually in some way is going to change your perception of the product. And, like, you know, and so my guess is for books, like, that is true for a lot of people. It's probably not true for you, but, like, if you're not an art aficionado, when you see a painting and then you figure out who the painter is, like, if it's some prominent painter, you rethink what you're looking at. Like, you just walk by it, but now you want to return and you want to see it. And it isn't because of the art. It's because it was created by the artist. And if we go back to wine, there's a market for, like, empty bottles of the Premier Cru or whatever, Screaming or whatever. And, you know, of course, part of that market is just fraud. Like, somebody's going to refill it and sell it. Part of the market is like, okay, so I put in the $2 chuck, but I take it to the restaurant. I have it uncorked. And I sit there at the big central table, and there's this lineup of bottles at the end. Right. But what I care about is that, you know, and people do, let me remove the eye from that comment, but people do, like, there's an actual market for these, more so in some cultures than others. And it's the actual affiliation that you get with the high status product that people are interested in versus the product per se.
Yeah. I would just add the example, which is in a way unrelated, but I think it's a similar psychological effect. When you buy a souvenir on a vacation and you buy a coffee mug or a tea towel or a keychain that reminds you of a trip, and it's a pretty cheesy piece of work the way it's been made, and you buy it anyway, some people do, because when they look at it, they get a good feeling. Not because it's aesthetically pleasing in and of itself, because it's tied to that experience, that vacation, I think that's a real effect. I don't want to suggest it's something wrong or fake about it. And, you know, similarly, you know, buying a product that is endorsed by a celebrity, using a tennis racket or a baseball bat or some kind of device that's been recommended or endorsed, literally is signed by, it's George Foreman's coffee cup, to mix gourmet metaphors, has an emotional impact on us that I don't think there's anything wrong with it per se. I don't think there's anything irrational per se about that. In fact, you could argue it's kind of a cool thing. I get a little taste of glory that I can't otherwise have. So I don't know if you agree with that.
Yeah, no, I mean, I totally agree with it. I've long ago left Homo economicus in the dustbin. Like, I have stopped generally comparing things to a rational benchmark, though it's a fun intellectual exercise to do that. You know, I've kind of, you know, again, like, where I spend so much time around behavioral economists and psychologists and social psychologists that I'm pretty convinced that we're very much emotional decision makers. But where it becomes a central concept in the book is just like, so if there is this positive feedback loop where it's like, okay, so if a product is appreciated more or admired more, like a painting, because it was created by a prominent, prestigious, anointed artist, right, then we're going to end up in this feedback loop where, you know, the artist is actually better because they made a good painting, but they made a good painting because they're a good artist, but that, right, and so you actually can end up in these cycles where because you're of high repute, what you do is highly regarded, and because it's highly regarded, you're of even possibly higher repute, or you at least reinforce your status. And that's this kind of endogenous dynamic that can happen if we make evaluations based on the prestige of the identity. And we tend to do that more when there's a lot of ambiguity about how good something is. Yeah. Like, it's that uncertainty where it's like, we're just not really sure. Like, you know, if I buy an Electrolux vacuum cleaner and I take it home and it doesn't pick up dust, right, I'm not going to say, like, oh, it is, I'm going to elevate the status of the brand. Like,
but Martha Stewart endorsed it.
Yeah, exactly. Well, right. I mean, so there are these products where, and, you know, weirdly, there are products where they're, you know, I sort of get into this a little bit in the book, but like, if you're a social scientist, you just wouldn't expect status dynamics there, but they are anyways. But as a general rule, the more ambiguity there is about how we think about something, like a book or a job candidate who we haven't met, or you know, a piece of art, or I get into this a lot because the other part of my life is I live in tech and entrepreneurship. Outside of my academic role, that's what I do, and I've, you know, for 20 years run entrepreneurship programs at the Elite Business School. So a startup is another thing that is nearly impossible to assess at an early stage. And that's one of the ways I got into studying status, was in the world of tech and science, where I think status dynamics are enormously important. Okay, you were going to go, to take you back, well, you were about to,
no,
to work
gonna,
for
bees. But no, I'm going to push it to a different, I want to stay on this topic for a minute, because I want to, you've encouraged me to give you a hard time on this. What you're suggesting, which I think is absolutely true, is that anointment and the role of status and hierarchy is more important in products that don't have objective measures of quality, art, wine, etc. And is that a good thing? And let me make the case. You know, there's a famous story, which I suspect is true, that in his old age and fame, Picasso would go into a restaurant and they'd get the bill and he would make a doodle on the bill and sign it. And that would be his way of paying, because his doodle was of value, because he's Pablo Picasso. Now, I can't do that. One, I'm an objectively bad artist, but is it a bad thing that Picasso, who You can still debate whether he's any good. There are a lot of people, I'm sure, who hate Picasso's work, but many do seem to love it, and I think love it for all kinds of reasons that are real. The fact that those certain people are given the authority and power to use their blessing, in this case, a doodle is more than a blessing, and actually could have monetary value. But I'm talking about now the fact that Picasso picks a young artist and elevates that person reputationally, which in music and art and theater and all literature, there are all kinds of examples where people emerge from darkness because of the endorsement of a great artist. That seems like a good thing, because, and the reason I would defend it is that those people who have that power usually have passed some kind of test. You could debate it, whether it's any value at all, because it's so subjective. But the Picasso's Picasso. Now, I don't think I'm totally fooled by the power of his art. And so is it really surprising or even bad that those people have outsized influence on who else? I mean, it would be sinister if they chose people and then abused them, right? Because they had this power over them, that they were bribable and used their endorsement power that way. But I don't think that would degrade their reputation potentially if people didn't like what they suggested, if you think there's any agency left. But anyway, is it really so bad?
So there's so much in that one. Is it so bad? I mean, so a lot of the book isn't like, I don't mean to be making normative judgments about these things in the book. So is it so bad? I would argue that there are, like, take art, like nearly everyone's an artist. And then there's a giant number of professional artists, like people who would actually claim that, you know, that art is my profession. There's a giant, I don't know what the number is, but there's a giant number of artists. But there's a finite amount of wall space at the Metropolitan Museum of Art.
Yep.
An extremely finite amount of wall space, or floor space. So we have these organizations. They're organizations where people have collectively decided they'll view art, right? I mean, there's public art, there's other places, you can put art anywhere, but they're these places with a very finite resource, which is wall space. So there's another version of that which comes before the museum, which is there are art galleries, and there's a whole, like, complete pecking order, yep, of prestige in the gallery world, and much of the curation happens long before the museum. It's, you know, what artist does Larry Gagosian decide to put on the walls of his gallery, and I would make a couple of points. One is I think that choice is almost never purely about merit. And second, there is no concept of merit, because if you took a panel of, if you had 10 gallerists who are all great contemporary art gallerists, and you had them look at 100 new artists each, I'm not even sure there'd be overlap in which one they chose to put on the wall. So that's, you know, that's ex ante. That's before anything happens. Once Gagosian puts an artist on the wall, it's game over. And so anointment in the art world is getting to the Gagosian wall. And if you get to the Gagosian wall, you're then probably going to, you know, go, you know, slightly downtown to the MoMA's wall eventually, because, you know, you've been anointed by one of the most influential versions of a critic in the business. But if I think about it from the standpoint of consumer choice, like, you and I can have this conversation because we both know exactly who Pablo Picasso is. So we wouldn't even have the conversation if there wasn't some status process in the art world that decided, like, who we should be looking at and who we should be talking about and who we should be having the conversation about. So this is what I mean when I say there's, like, this status dynamics that sit behind the scenes. Like, you know, there's, like, a million and one things that happened before you ever got to the museum and saw who was on the wall. But my view is, if you rerun history, like, take the thought experiment where you just rerun the history of art, that we would in all times, in all cases, end up with different artists on the walls of the MoMA, because there wasn't one objectively greater than everybody else artist. Like, we've constructed that story, but there was some other immensely creative Picasso that you've never heard of and never will. I mean, there were probably dozens of other versions of that. But like the anointment dynamic didn't unfold for them, but it did unfold for Pablo. So, you know, but is it normatively bad? Like, it's normatively, in my view, unfair based on most of our, you know, fairness is a very funny word, like do an episode on that one. Like I once heard a prominent economist, actually it was a guy called Michael Jensen, in a meeting, like I said something's unfair, and he said, yeah, unfair means you don't like it, and fair means you like it. So, you know, so whatever the definition is of fairness, that's its own can of worms. But I think the outcomes that are created by the status process, most of us would look at that and say, well, it's not exactly fair.
Yeah, it's a fascinating, I love the thought experiment. I would just say about the gallery art sequence, it reminds me of my experience as an author when I was shopping for agents. And at some point I realized the goal was not to convince the agent that your book was worth it, was quality or wonderful. It was to convince the agent that an editor would find it worthwhile. And because that's what an agent does. An agent doesn't decide what's a good book. An agent decides what editors think is a good book. And it's just, it's a small thing, but I think it's true. And I also agree that because of the subjective nature of reputation, we can debate whether this plays out over time in a different way. I mean, we recently had the episode on For Whom the Bell Tolls and Hemingway, and, you know, Hemingway's reputation went down, and it's doing pretty well, actually. It's doing better than Theodore Dreiser, just for example, or other people who, as you point out, you know, we've never heard of, who were modest successes in the 1940s and 50s, say. But I don't find anything sinister about it. I think in what we're talking about, it's inevitable. It's not fair. When you told the story about Michael Jensen, who I know a little bit, I thought you were going to say, economists don't do fair. That's another standard thing you hear from economists. But I don't know whether it's fair or not. There is an inequity or an injustice, certainly, in the fact that some wonderfully talented poets, composers, artists, authors don't make it and others do. But I don't find it sinister. Do you?
No, not at all. And in fact, a central point in the book is that the reason we have the status system is functional. Like we have a curatorial problem, right? And we just talked about art, but we could do the same thing in books. Like there's this enormous funnel in all the world, right? And so the curatorial function, you know, problem in books is that there's also a ton of people who consider themselves writers and have written or are writing a book. And so you have an enormous amount of content, but you actually have a very small amount of shelf space in a physical bookstore. And we could argue whether Amazon's any different or not. But, you know, the reality of online anything is that if you have, you know, whatever, 3 million SKUs or however many book titles there are on Amazon, might be more than that, it's still finite shelf space because you're going to have to organize the content in a way where people see some of it and not others of it. And so there's the collaborative filter, and there's, you know, product placements and all the things that happen when you're searching online. And so we need some way to curate things. I mean, and then let's go to the modern world, which is, you know, we're talking about sort of cultural content, but another form of cultural content is social media. And literally in the span of time that it takes you and I, we're both a bit verbose, it seems, but the time it takes for you or I to complete a thought, there's more content that's been uploaded to, you know, TikTok, Instagram, you know, Facebook, Snap, and, you know, and WeChat, like whatever, you know, whatever is left. Like there's more content created in the span of this than I could view in my entire lifetime. Let's throw YouTube in there, literally, like if you did the math on it. So in that long-winded thing, hundreds of thousands of videos have been uploaded onto the internet, right? And so And so you have this, it's just like literally, you can't imagine, none of us can imagine, you know, what these petabytes of data, like the amount of content that is. But, you know, we sit down in front of our phone and we're going to start scrolling and we have to start somewhere. And like non-random is probably going to be better than random. And, you know, and then lying behind that is some status-like process that, you know, determines what goes viral and what doesn't and what gets your attention. But it isn't, I mean, it's not sinister in the sense of like, we need some mechanism to accomplish that feat, to take this super wide funnel and winnow it down to, a consumable version of a choice set. It's just that most of us just accept the choice set as it's given to us and don't really think that much about like how it all got there. And it's really important in terms of like who gets what opportunities to understand the process by which it got there.
You have a section on the downside of being anointed, which I found extremely interesting. We had Tim Ferriss on the program recently, and we discussed an essay he wrote sometime in the, I can't remember when he wrote it, after he became pretty famous, now he's more famous. And it was about, it was basically be careful what you wish for, because his life has some negatives that I couldn't imagine. And so it's a very, very powerful essay, because when you become famous in the modern era, it's has a dark side, and you don't go into the full range of darkness, but you talk about some of the examples. You talk about impostering privilege and less discerning consumers when restaurants get a Michelin star. Talk about some of those.
Yeah. I mean, let's start with the restaurants. I mean, that's a fun one. So, so if you're a foodie, then you definitely pay attention to Michelin ratings, right? This is super influential ratings. And there's a very small number of restaurants in the world that have stars. And so you would think if you're a restaurateur, unambiguously, what you want is like the Nobel Prize of restaurants, which is, you know, the Michelin 3-star. Like that's unambiguously what you want. But, you know, your whole life changes when that happens. And so I started to like chase down Michelin starred chefs, because that was just for me, that was the book. There's 100 examples of stuff in the book, and you know, and they're like the ones I found interesting or fun as I was writing it. And so it turns out there's this group of chefs, and they literally handed back their stars. And the story I found that I most liked the most was this restaurant in Spain, where, you know, it was like a kind of a village restaurant where like people would, you know, come and break bread, and, you know, families would eat there and they'd have conversations and it would be crowded but casual. And then he started experimenting, did some inventive things with the menu. Michelin comes along and they star it. Okay, but then when they star it, you then enter, if you're in this world, you enter, one thing is you jump on top of a hamster wheel, because the star isn't like you have it forever and ever and ever and ever. Like, you know, there's certain, if you're a writer and you win a Pulitzer Prize, you'll always carry it around. But the star is one of those versions of anointment where you have to re-earn it every year, because, you know, the guy reassesses restaurants. And if you think about it, like I also spent a lot of time looking into and thinking about the process by which we create rankings and ratings. Like, I mean, you are absolutely not going to crack open the U.S. News and World Report college rankings every year if every year Harvard is 1, you know, Yale is 2, Princeton is 3, Stanford is 4, MIT is 5, and the University of Chicago is 6. Like, if every year those are the top 6, okay, let's say, it's uninteresting, right? So you have to change the rankings, like by literally changing the criteria on which you're going to rank. So you resort, or just, you know, reweight so that the rankings change. So anyways, if you're a Michelin star chef, there's this enormous amount of pressure to maintain you know, the quality, and I'm going to put quality in quotes and come back to that in a second, but maintain the quality that justifies a Michelin star. But the second thing is, now all of a sudden, like the whole, everything that happens in the restaurant changes, because it goes from like people driving in from a, you know, 20 kilometer radius or 5 kilometer radius or, you know, whatever, like coming to the restaurant, seeing friends, like you imagine, you know, some version of Cheers, but, you know, Spanish village style. But now it's like, you know, people who are foodies who are coming in from wherever, because they have to try the food at this Michelin starred restaurant. So the audience completely changes to an audience that's looking for something else, right? What they want is pictures to put on their Instagram feeds to show the world that they've been here, or to consume the experience in some way that's radically different than the experience that happened before the star. So, like, you know, it literally, it's one of these things where it changes your world. If you generalize a little bit beyond that, one is there's a lot of visibility of high status actors. Like, you know, we are like, think about all of the New York Post and whatever, there's like, and Reddit and like whatever happens, like if a celebrity does anything, the world pays attention to it. So you do lose your privacy, but you're also constantly on the stage. So managing your brand or your status becomes a, you know, a 24/7 job, particularly in the social media world. There are lots of things that change about life if you join the truly anointed set. You know, the one that I think is most general and most interesting, and that people struggle with the most, is some version of the imposter syndrome, you know, what we now call the imposter syndrome, or some kind of anxiety that you have, because usually if you're high status in whatever your field is, doesn't matter, you're in front of audiences often, and audiences form very high expectations because they think of you as, you know, being great at what you do. And if in fact you're a little less great than your position in the status hierarchy would suggest, that the rational response to that, I mean, rational in the sense, the characteristic response for that that represents the situation you're in. I'm walking into a room, everybody thinks I'm going to be absolutely amazing. I'm less amazing than they think. I'm going to disappoint people. Therefore, imposter syndrome, right? I mean, so, or some version of anxiety. That is actually the rational response to a world in which the distribution of status is super right-tailed, where you have these very, very prominent actors, but the distribution of merit or talent is less skewed.
Yeah, it's a fascinating example. And I think about it a lot. I think about athletes who are, you know, in the top 10th of a percent or whatever it is of their skill set, they get nervous.
Yeah.
For all kinds of reasons. Part of it is simply disappointing their fans. It's nice to be anointed in a field where it's easier to keep quality constant. You know, I would suggest a singer has a certain advantage, but of course, singers get colds and their voices aren't quite up to what they want. And they have that anxiety, I'm sure, even without that. So it's probably a myth that there's some fields where people don't have imposter syndrome. But I think when we look at those people, we think, well, they're so talented or they're so this or that. But that's not the way we see ourselves often in those settings. It's fascinating. Do you think anointing is less important than it was 50 years ago, and maybe less important than it will be in 50 years because of what I would call the death of expertise? Or is it just that being anointed is more democratic than it used to be? Obviously, there are influencers on Instagram and TikTok who weren't anointed by anybody. They just caught fire for reasons that have nothing to do with their status ex ante. Now they have some status. They can bestow goodies on folks if they want. But I wonder about this. It seems to me the world's a little less hierarchical than it used to be. Do you agree?
So the last statement I unambiguously agree with, in at least a grander historical time frame. So let's come back to 50 years. Like, the last 50 years are really interesting, and the next five are going to be wild, in my opinion. But the last 50 are interesting. So in the grand scheme of things, you know, in the book, you know, we never got back to worker bee. So can I take you back? I'm gonna you back there for a minute. So please. So in the book, you know, I argue there's like 3.5 sources of status. The one, you know, that we're talking about with expertise, and the one that I think most of us just sort of conceptually think of would be a fair source of status, is some version of merit. Now, merit alone is a problematic idea. Like, so the idea would be people with a lot of merit who do things that are really good, are really valuable, are really high quality, are the ones that should have high status. So status is a reward for being really, really, really good at something. Now, the way status works in reality is, like, you know, we often will think about global status. We'll have this conversation about a tenth of a percent, a thousandth of a percent, like the most recognized artist or the most, you know, the athletes we watch on television or whatever. But every social group has a status hierarchy, like your work group in the office does. And weirdly, like, you go into a yoga class and there's a status hierarchy. Like, you know, there's the one who's like, who can bend in that way. I mean, I long ago gave those up, but, you know, so there are status hierarchies everywhere, and what constitutes merit, you know, merit-based contributions to a group is very different across every version of the groups that we have. But one source of status is absolutely, it's given to the people who are the best at doing whatever is valued in that context. You know, so there are, I think, quality differences among writers, and they're actually like the quality of the writing, and that affects to some extent the prestige of the writer. The second thing is, and that's what the book calls worker bee status. You earn it, you work for it. The second thing is, all societies at all times and all places allocate status differently to what sociologists call ascribed characteristics. And the way you think about it, an ascribed characteristic is there's a whole bunch of characteristics that you have that were just kind of, you know, for is an awkward way to say it, but were assigned to you at birth. Like, you were born to you were born into a religion, into a skin color. You were born male or female. Like, you had the SRY gene or whatever it is, or you didn't. You were born, you're probably going to be tall or you're going to be short. All the characteristics that are just given to you, like, you didn't choose them. You chose none of those. And if everything was redone, I mean, if there is a you, you would get different characteristics. But we order those. Like, they all have status consequences. And in past versions of society, there's no mobility out of them. That is, whatever you were born into is where you end up. And, you know, that's kind of the iron rule of law. So if you think about, like, a rigid caste system or a feudal system, like, you know, in a feudal system, you don't go ask the kid who's working in the field, you know, what they want to do when they finish college, right? You know, they're going to work in the field, like, you know, like their father did, and like their children will. That's the system. Like, there is no mobility. But we get status from these ascribed characteristics, and we're all dealt a different hand there, depending on, you know, where we are and what we got. And then the third place where we get status is, it's kinetic. It's, you get anointed. That is, the high stat, the people who have status in the system move it around by choosing who to affiliate with or not. And that happens everywhere all the time. So, you know, every university has an admissions committee and decides who to let, you know, through the campus gates and who not to let through the campus gates. And from, you know, from the bottom of the pecking order all the way up to the elite universities, these are status conferring institutions, right? And when they confer status, they do. But that happens in all walks of life, everywhere. So we have these like three ways in which we create status. Now let's come back to the question of whether it's more important now than it was 50 years ago. I mean, I think first empirically there isn't a way to do that study or answer that question. But conceptually, what's happened is there is now this complete change in what I would call the scale or the geography of status that's created by the internet, the smartphone, the global platforms with 4 billion users or whatever the numbers are at for the biggest global platforms now, you know, north of 500 million, but all the way up to, you know, something like 3 or 4 billion people in one place. And what that allows somebody to do is have global recognition, whereas 50 years ago, that was a much harder task, right? We lived in a more local world. And if you go back, 50 years before that, like before anything was digitized, we lived in a way more local world. And there, you know, status is still super important, but nobody can achieve true global status because there's no way to get the distribution where you're in front of, you know, the kind of the population of the planet. Now you can get that distribution. So the scale of the anointment dynamic, I think, has changed with the global distribution of content. But I don't think there's even a way to think about or know whether it's more important or not.
It's just that point about scale. It's, you know, it's true of any economic activity. It's part of the reason we get to a world where the rewards are so disproportionate. If you can appeal to an international audience, I'm watching Crash Landing on You, which is a Korean show very much focused on North and South Korean differences, and which I'm sure I do not fully appreciate. It's in Korean. I watch it with subtitles and I love it. And of course, that's a very different world where I have to go to North Korea or South Korea and watch a play in, you know, with 100 people that's held in the daytime because there's no lighting for evening performances. So the world has changed tremendously. And the rewards, obviously, for athletes and performers who can have international appeal. Shohei Ohtani is an obvious example in baseball. You know, Michael Jordan was that person. Muhammad Ali was that person. Adele is that person. These folks have wildly, enormously greater rewards than the, as you point out, the second best or the whatever further down the scale. It's the rewards are very skewed.
Sorry to interrupt, but you have me now thinking about Korea and like, you know, and so like take K-pop, like where, you know, his K-pop song, you know, whoever, you know, I'm outside of my bailiwick, but, you know, these K-pop songs go like global and, you know, they create global megastars, but, you know, 50 years ago that couldn't happen. Like there was no way to happen. And then, you know, a Korean film, like it's been this series of Korean films that, you know, like Best Picture at the Academy Awards, right? And that's a modern world phenomenon where if you create content, it's possible to distribute it to global audiences and get this like just vastly greater benefit from, you know, whatever recognition you have. Like, I mean, so, you know, when Beyonce issues her next song, like it's not just going to be us here in, you know, we Americans listening to this, like it's going to be everywhere all at once.
Nice. I do want to add that Econ Talk is heard in 200 countries. But I don't want to get you too excited about that, Toby. Some of those are quite
that's
small.
That's amazing.
I didn't know there were 200 countries. Countries. I was shocked to discover this. There's more than 200, but we're about in every one of them. At least that gets measured by an IP address. Let's close with talking about AI. You alluded to it earlier. We don't know at this moment how important AI will be in our lives. 6 weeks ago, I was pretty sure it was going to be enormous. Now, I'm starting to wonder, maybe it's not as important as I thought. We'll see. But it will affect status, and it will affect anointing. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, so I know a little bit about what you think about it, because one of the episodes I listened to was your Dwarkesh.
That was weeks ago. My thinking, I've moved on from there.
Yeah, I mean, well, okay, but my guess is Dwarkesh hasn't moved on. I'll throw that out there. I mean, if what you're thinking about is some kind of disappointment with GPT-5 or whatever, I literally think if you stopped AI today, which you will not, because one of the things that's gone on, I'm sure you're aware of this, is the there are four companies that this year will spend more on investments in AI than NASA spent to send a man to the moon over a 14-year period. Like, this is in like 2025 CapEx alone is, that number looks to be north of $300 billion spent by four companies. Like, there has never in human history been an investment at the scale of this. And that investment is going to pay dividends or extract a toll of epic proportion. I don't know how to think about that. I am 100% convinced, positive, that AI is going to change most things about nearly everything. So I think it's just the most profound change in human history. But coming back from that, let's talk about the status system. So the first thing, I've been trying to editorialize on this in the limited time I've had in the last couple of weeks. So the first thing I think it's going to do is reinforce the prestige hierarchy. Like, we are going to pay. I think that the net effect of AI right now, and my little research group is spinning up. We work on mainly like computational social science kinds of projects. So we work on very large data sets and look for look at things. So I'm doing a ton of things on the job market right now, but I'm also starting up a set of projects that are going to look at whether we are in the short term more heavily relying on pedigree than we have in the past. And the argument for that is that, like, take, the most important argument for that is take writing. So I think for all of human history, I mean, since we invented, the written word, language, and instruments to communicate, we have made assessments of people based on writing. So we do that when you apply for a job. You write historically, you write a cover letter and you write a resume. We do it when you apply to go to a college, and we do it when you're grading anything at any point in life, like you write something and then it's graded. And so writing has been this thing, and it's everywhere, by the way. I mean, I'm looking at us and I'm thinking, for some reason, like, and then there's your blurb on your dating site profile. Like, it's used to evaluate you everywhere. But writing high quality content just got to be, nearly universally available and basically free. So there's not a person in the United States with access to a state-of-the-art AI system that can't prompt a very good college admissions essay. I mean, far better than the average one. Like, if you took the history of college essays and assembled them all and compared them to a bunch of prompted essays, I guarantee you, with today's models, I guarantee you the average quality of what you just prompted is far above the history of the college essay sample. But you just took a signal about that we've long used to make assessments of people, and you've occluded it. And now we're back to where the conversation started. Right, we used to have this pretty easy way to assess someone, and now it's gone. So now we've taken sort of the written word, and the same goes for skills assessment. Like, there's all of these. You can't, if you want to figure out how good a coder is, you need to now take them into a room disconnect the internet, watch them write code, because you can't rely on anything else, not a GitHub repository, not a not an online examination. Like, it's a wonky world where we go back to this, you can't judge quality, right? Because we don't know whether the content was created by the person or the machine, or like a collaboration of the person and the machine. And when you can't judge quality, that's precisely the time in which you rely on pedigree. So like, if you're a college admissions officer, take that problem at a place where a lot of people want to go. You can't figure out, you know, it's very hard now to read an essay and say, I'm admitting them because this is an outstanding essay, if that ever happened. But what you can do is you can say, like, I've heard of the high school, or, you know, there's some other status marker on the background. And so I'm going to overweight that relative to information that formerly was a signal, but now it's just noise.
Yeah, it's a fascinating thing. And I'm not 100% sure it's going to change everything about everything. I felt that way about 3 months ago. I am a little more skeptical, but it clearly has changed. I would say it's changed the ability to write a mediocre, a pretty good essay. I think people will still compete at prompts, which is really a thin reed to lean on for many yeah. people into college or a job. It's going to be a very different world just for that. Like you say, even if it doesn't advance in the next 18 months, and I do suspect it will. And if it advances, we'll see.
I mean, we had a little hope that prompt engineering was going to be a thing, but then came the reasoning models, and it's not really a thing anymore. So, I mean, there's complex prompting to generate, you know, agentic AI systems, but, you know, but I think we already are at the point where it's a very good writer, and there's new approaches to how it's being trained to become an excellent writer. And so, but I mean, the thing you have to keep in mind when you look at it is, like, you're looking at this, like, think about what it's learned between model, you know, between Gemini 1.5 and Gemini 2.5, or GPT-4 and GPT-5. Like, it's immensely better at stuff. But it's learned all that in, you know, what, 4 months, 6 months, like whatever the time interval is between major model introductions. It's learned at a rate that, you know, it took us humans like a century to learn that, right? I mean, it's just astonishing what's happening. But, you know, but I don't think we know yet how it's going to affect things. I think short run, we see a heavy reliance on pedigree. Longer run, I think it actually could really uproot the whole system, right? Because now let's go back to where we opened, and I said I've given up on choice, and you said you'll never give up on choice. But one of the ways I've given up on choice is I now routinely say, like, you know, I bought a beard clipper on Amazon a couple of weeks ago. And like, that's normally the kind of decision I hate to make. Like, I get onto Amazon and there's like, you know, 1,000 of the damn things. And I can't tell the difference.
They're all rated well.
They all have, like, you know, they're between
4.3. Yeah.
They don't mean anything, but they're all between 4.4 and 4.6 or whatever. You know, there's no information in the ratings. Like, you know, I can, like, look at which ones I like aesthetically. You know, I will sit and think there'll be like some irrelevant price difference to me. And I'll sit and think about, like, do I want to pay that? So instead, I took an AI system and I entered a prompt. And I made it my agent. I said, I want you to choose one. Like, I want it to be between these two price points. I could care less about the brand. You go read the reviews. You go do the work. You bring me back. You bring me back one, not two, one. And so it eliminated the choice for me. And I am going to use that all the time. And it made, you know, by any standard, you know, we have to figure out what it does when it processes information. But I think by any standard of rationality, it made a more rational choice than I would have done, and a certainly more expeditious one from my standpoint.
Let's close with a personal reflection. You've been writing about this to write the book. You thought about it a lot before that. You've been studying it. Has it affected your own human craving for status, do you think?
So no one's asked me that question. I mean, I don't know if it's because of the book or not, but I think about status in some ways, my own status, much less than I used to, like much less. So I've had this, you know, kind of interesting academic trajectory where you might argue that I've migrated downwards by choice in the status hierarchy. I mean, and, you know, also like factoring in the job offers I've had. I mean, Berkeley's an amazing university, so it's totally, you know, it's great.
You're not slumming.
I'm not slumming, but I did move from Harvard to Berkeley, and that's not a common move that people make. But I think, you know, from my own, you know, status, like I think mostly about professional status, but that's because I'm a workaholic. So I spend so much time working and then, you know, doing like that is the vast majority of the time that I spend, I work. So I think much less about it, but I think that's like age and career stage and where I am in life. Like I have what I need for sure. But what I will say is that the book got me to be very reflective about how people respond to status. And for me, that was the most personal and the most interesting probably chapter to write, was how, if you have high status, you respond, and the cost of having low status, which I've thought a lot about over my career, but maybe in a sort of more objective kind of academic way, because I've worked a lot on, you know, on status differences based on ascribed characteristics and what that does to equitable opportunity. That's been like, you know, the sort of peer reviewed research, lots of it. So I thought a lot about that, and, you know, but then when I wrote the book, I just thought a lot more about like the human reaction, the emotional reaction, what this all means for people's sort of internal states versus the, you know, the sort of more external stuff. And all of that absolutely does, you know, change you in ways that probably are hard to put your finger on. But I think, you know, anyone who writes a book, like it is a bit of a personal journey, almost no matter what the topic is, because it has, you know, even more than I think usual in the academic world, it sort of, it assigns you to a quiet place, right? I mean, you are going to spend a lot of time, you know, probably sitting alone, thinking, writing, researching, reading stuff. And so it's a reflective undertaking, I think, no matter what. But, you know, this topic for me, very, very much so.
My guest today has been Toby Stewart. His book is Anointed. Toby, thanks for being part of EconTalk.
Love the conversation. Thanks for having me, Russ.
This is Econ Talk, part of the Library of Economics and Liberty. For more Econ Talk, go to econtalk.org, where you can also comment on today's podcast and find links and readings related to today's conversation. The sound engineer for Econ Talk is Rich Goyette. I'm your host, Russ Roberts. Thanks for listening. Talk to you on Monday.